Hey everybody, time for another Shop Talk show. This is episode number 228. Dave and I are going to answer a whole bunch of your questions. Let's see, what are we going to talk about? An interesting use case for junk CSS, or should we call it extras.css? What are up with these tombstone things that people are talking about? What's up with HTML imports these days? What if you needed to store a bunch of data in Jekyll and access it in an interesting kind of way? How would you do that? Those questions and many more are coming up here on Shop Talk Show. I should mention that this episode is brought to you in part by brand new sponsor, Codascope Jax. Jax helps JavaScript developers secure their source code as they build their applications. Jax analyzes your GitHub repositories, highlights areas that can be improved, and provides expert training and patches to help you do it. It's free for developers to use on an unlimited number of repositories. Sign up today at codascope.com/shoptalk or follow the link in the show notes, of course. This episode is also brought to you in part by Braintree Payments. Mobile app development can be complex, but integrating your payments no longer has to be. With Braintree, your business can accept nearly every type of payment from any device with just one integration. Learn more at braintreepayments.com/shoptalk.
Hey there, Shopomaniacs! You're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show, an advice podcast where we tell you how to build your website. I'm Dave Rupert with Miss Chris Coyer.
Mr. Manners, Chris Coyer.
Hey
tell
there.
You not only how to do a website, but how to do it well and how to do it politely.
How to do it kindly. Start off with a firm handshake. That's the best way to get a website going.
Always change out your dinner fork for a smaller dessert fork. I don't know anything about manners. I wish I learned earlier on the day. This show is actually about web design and development, front end, sometimes a little back end. As a matter of fact, we have a little follow-up from our last episode. And this one's from Anders Negrin, who says he's a college student who just does a ton of like Hello World stuff, you know, to try out different languages, I think is really cool. I think that's a smart thing to do at any age. And remember last week, or maybe I think it was last week, we were talking about the HHVM, and it's like this like Facebook generated like way that like compiles PHP to C or something. But apparently that's not all it does. There's like hack is a thing that like is paired with it somehow, and I'm probably missing the mark again, so I apologize for that. But I wanted to. Anders had a statement. He said one of the cool things about hack is this thing called XHP, and he says it looks a little bit like React for PHP, and I looked at it, and it kind of does. Now, if you think React is like a way for handling DOM stuff for you, you're right, and PHP can't do that, right, because it's just a server-side language. What he means, though, is it's kind of like JSX part of which I guess JSX isn't really part of React, but that's what it looks like. You know how you're writing PHP and all the, you know, you're switching back and forth between HTML and PHP, so all the time you're like opening and closing PHP tags, and there's like never a comfortable way to like decide when to close one and when to open one and when to break to a new line, and I always find it like highly awkward, you know? Anyway, this is like part of hack has this way where you don't have to do that. It kind of just naturally knows what's HTML and what isn't. It probably parses the syntax in some cool way. And you know how you get really comfortable with JSX? I could see that kind of being kind of awesome in PHP. And it was corroborated on Twitter. What did that tweet say? I feel it's like we missed the mark kind of thing.
Yeah, I think people are kind of like, you don't know a thing.
We don't.
But I think people like they're like, it's just like Babel for PHP. It gives you like super PHP on the end or transpiles it to something.
Yeah, but so. Speed is also part of the thing. It has to be. I think that.
Yeah, totally. So if you're used to using something like Babel or Sass, you know, you might be like very comfortable with transpilers and
transmogrifiers, but yeah, so I mean,
you do hear of it less on back end languages. You know, you generally think of, like, it feels weird to use a preprocessor for a back end language, but they exist, and this is they one exist. Of them.
I was going to point out, I think, you know, I was talking to somebody, I think this question was kind of about like speeding up PHP or whatever. Somebody pointed me to a Craft CMS podcast or craftpodcast.com episode 10 is all about performance. And so they get in really like high level about HTTP 2.
Yeah.
They get into like PHP 7 and why you should be on both of these. And, and you know, we've both kind of self-admittedly, like, we're going to let PHP or H2 and PHP 7 blow up in somebody else's face before we let it blow up in our face.
I mean, I had some help because I'm using PHP 7 and HTTP 2 on CSS Tricks, but I had Media Temple's help, who aren't sponsoring this particular episode, but have sponsored Shop Talk Show in the past. I'm sure most of you know they help you with that, and it really is smoking fast.
Yeah. So I think our quote, like our pull quote, was, you know, the PHP is really never the problem. They would disagree entirely with us. And so I think, like, for the balance, you know, fair and balanced media that we try to give you on Shop Talk Show, listen to that podcast, because it's very much like, you know, Nginx, PHP 7, H2, like, it's people who really enjoy that stuff. So I think you should listen to them. So,
you know, and as a front end podcast, you know, you've heard, and I'm sure we've proliferated the idea that performance is like 80% front end. You've heard that before, right? I think maybe that was even a Steve Soders kind of thing that he kind of coined ish. I believe it to be true as well, but it is it depends on that time to first byte being really fast. Like, if your time to first byte is like 100 milliseconds, that's awesome. And then performance really is all on the front end. But I find that to not always be the case. You know, like, if your time to first byte is 3 seconds, that sucks. You know, like, then your performance problems really are on the back end. So calling it 80-20 is true when your back end is fine or whatever. But it often isn't. I think it's more of like a 50-50 game in reality, is that you're spending time optimizing performance on either end of front and back end is usually worth your time, because you got to get that time to first byte really, really fast. Which is basically your HTML document. That needs to hit the browser fast so the browser can start doing stuff.
And I probably talked about this, but I went through Daytrip and I like optimized all my database queries. I called it DB query golf, like got them from like 60 queries per view down to like 6. And that's sped up. I mean, we're talking 100, 200 milliseconds per view. So it does matter. So
I'm looking at your right now. I mean, your back end is, you know, preface, and this is an interesting thing to talk about as well, but I'm hitting 100 middle hundreds of milliseconds or low 100 milliseconds for your time to first byte on Go Daytrip, which is awesome. Like, that's as fast as you're going to get. That's as fast as any website always is. But that's me, you know, in the United States, in Chrome, with my fast bandwidth or whatever. But still, that's your back end being fast. And I wanted you to, where was the last time we were talking about the, like, maybe it was in the last episode, where instead of just saying that, be like, my website's fast. That doesn't really mean anything, because I didn't preface it with all of the stuff. And you're like, here's the deal. Here's like the new bar should be 3G.
3G on a Nexus phone.
Yeah.
Like, I think I like really, that,
because it gives us a standard bar to talk about. So it's not just me saying, oh, the website's fast. It's me saying, no, the website's fast on these particular bit.
Yeah, it's like the it's fast to me is like works on my computer, you know. It's like, no, we need like we all need to have like a similar version of the same computer to discuss fast, you know, something kind of subjective like fast, you know. So anyhow, I guess listen to that podcast. Anders, thank you for writing in. That's, you know, we don't know everything. We know we know a decent amount, but thank you for kind of keeping us sharp on that. And I don't know, XHP looks okay. It gets rid of that question mark soup. So that's nice. But all right, let's kick it off. Chris Steve Polito writes in, I use SAS on all my web projects. I'm under the impression I should not be committing my automatically generated CSS file since it's not being authored by me. However, if I don't commit the file, how can I deploy it to my server? I use DeployHQ. That's deployhq.com. They are not sponsoring the show. We'll send an invoice. As my development service, which is connected to all my projects' repos. If there is no CSS file in my repo, how can it be deployed? Chris, where do you stand? I'm just like, if your deployment environment requires it,
it's not the biggest deal in the world to have your committed CSS in your repo, I don't think. Like, we do it on Chop Talk Show, I'm sure. We might not even be using a preprocessor anymore. And so.
Yeah. Well, where the only place it blows up is if you work with other people.
Well, the merge conflicts thing is kind of annoying. I've always said that, like, if you have a merge conflict though in your generated CSS, but not in any other thing, just like screw it. Just like pick one or the other. It doesn't matter, because then because there wasn't a merge conflict in the actual like .scss or whatever, just run the compilation again and then commit the newly generated one and just be like, no, this is fine.
Yeah, real quick, you'll have to recommit that
real quick, because you would, especially if all your commits were like going to production or something, which they shouldn't be anyway, but. Yeah, you would want to do it quickly. So that's annoying. And I think people would argue that like just having this kind of useless file in Git that human beings don't touch is like not the like spirit of Git. It's like unnecessary that it's in there. But I would say like generally people leave it in there. I would say most repos it's in there because it does require like some next level kind of DevOps stuff in order to not have it in there. That means that your deployment process has to like do more than just move files. You know, like I'm a fan of Beanstalk. I love it. Beanstalk doesn't do anything other than like take some files that are in your repo and move them to a server. You can't tell it to be like, oh, but also while you're in there, I also want you to run these like Rails commands or like run this rake task or whatever. It's just, I mean, maybe there's commit hooks and stuff to do it. I'm sure there's some kind of way. But this isn't like a Capistrano setup or whatever. If you want to really get your CSS files out of there, you need like a next level deployment system. So I think that's just a lot of people stop short of that, and that's why they have their CSS files in their repo.
Yeah. So hopefully that helps you, Steve. I think it's just kind of if it fits your workflow, like you kind of, or if your workflow is it's a requirement, then do it. But I think the biggest backfire is that merge thing. All right, next question.
Yeah, Ken writes in, this is interesting. What's the best method for storing and working with simple, static, non-post data in a Jekyll site? So I have some experience with Jekyll. Dave has more, I'm sure. A lot of, like, there's post data in Jekyll, which means, like, you're writing a blog post and you save, like, a markdown file, and the top of the markdown file has, like, metadata and stuff in it about that post. This is, like, not that. This is some other kind of data, like maybe events or something. So he says, for example, we have 50 items that each have an associated category and description. I'd like to store this data somehow. Looks like he wants to store it in the repo as markdown, YAML, JSON, and then loop through it to populate a page, similarly to how you can loop through posts with something like Liquid. What would be the best way to store this data, and how would you go about getting it into the page without writing a ton of markup? What my mind goes to right away is like, I don't know, just do it client-side.
Yeah, you could do it client-side. There's a few tools you'll want to look at. There's Jekyll Archives, which does the, you know, categories and tags.
Okay.
Like, so that's a gem like plugin. You need to kind of add it in to your gem file and or your config.yaml that runs Jekyll. So that's a good like the category stuff. But if you want like a category description, it's a little bit weird because Jekyll doesn't provide that out of the box. So what I would do is create an underscore data folder, because Jekyll has this, And now you can just have like infinity flat file databases.
Really?
Yes. So you can put like, let's say categories.json or categories.yaml or whatever. And then you have the category title and the, you know, description. So it'd be like, like a hyphen space title, the events, then space, space, space to get all the white space right in YAML. Description equal colon. These are events. They are very cool.
Nice. And if you store it in YAML, then Jekyll knows how to parse it and deal with it and stuff.
Yeah. So it goes like it, now that data is available in site.data.file name. So
I see.
So categories, site.data.categories. And
parses it into this object-ish structure that you have access to. Yeah.
Yep. And then, so you say like, you just have to kind of like look, like loop through all those site.data.categories. And then it's like, if site.data.categories dot title or whatever, you'd have to do a for loop. So
yeah, write logic, write loops, do programming.
If cat.title equals, you know, your post category, then do this. And then you'd have to kind of like, you could do it. You just have to kind of like manually kind of do some hacks. And it's fun. You start getting into things. One thing I do with this data folder all the time is if I'm working on a client site, like a prototype or something, I will just like hit their API and get a big old thing of JSON, like real data from the client. And I will just like dump it in there. And now you have real data from the client that you're working into your prototype. You don't have to like make things up. So it's pretty cool way to build things.
I'm glad you had a good answer to that. I saw it and I was just like, oh, I don't know. Hopefully Dave knows.
Yeah. I mean, you could also do like the world's biggest switch statement, but that wouldn't be fun. Look into the data. And yeah. I should do a post on this because I've like built whole pattern labs and things like that in Jekyll
using
a lot of the data thing. It's kind of fun. Like you can get pretty deep and hack quite a bit. So, big fan of Jekyll, big fan. It does basically everything I want. So,
hey, let me tell you about one of our sponsors, a brand new sponsor here on Shop Talk Show. That is Codiscope, CODISCOPE.com/ShopTalk. And their product, Jax, as they say, flip the script on developer-driven security. What it does is it looks at your repos on GitHub, figures them all out, and offers expert recommendations on your code. Best practices and security stuff. It looks at your like Node projects, Express, MongoDB, Happy Spring, and like does data validation, data protection, security, state management, application flow, authentication. It looks at this stuff and says, this is what's wrong. This is what you can do better. It's totally free for an unlimited number of repositories. That's pretty impressive stuff. So thanks very much to Codiscope, their product Jax. So sign up at codiscope.com/shoptalk. Nice. All righty, Gabe. Luce writes in, should I put links to my website in the footer of my client's websites? Here's a couple of considerations. SEO. Accepted SEO mythology. I like that. Says that links to my website with keywords and the anchor text are valuable. Is this still relevant? Are there any SEO pitfalls on a WordPress website? For example, there would be the same link back to my website on every page of the site, which you think could be a problem. I've read recommendations to make all links except for the homepage rel nofollow. Then there's ethical and aesthetic reasons. Part of me really wants to have my name on the site, letting people know that I created it. But part of me feels like this is somewhat unprofessional or amateurish. I guess the real question is, will this help me get more work? I guess that's another one, too. So I'll let you go first. What do you think about this? Have you ever seen that? You go to a website and it says, like, designed and built by Dave Rupert or Parabell Inc.
Yeah, we used to do this all the time. I think why not? I don't know. I think at a certain point, it does become like a style choice, you know, like, do you need to put your stamp of approval on this, you know, or like when we did the Microsoft site, like, we're not going to put our
link in there. No, there's no way they would let you do that. They were cool about being public about the creation of it, but that's what strikes me. It's like, what client is going to let you do that?
Yeah, and that's kind of the thing is, like, I don't know. But if it's like a, like, I don't know, just a small site for a friend or something, just be like, hey, here you go. This helps my business. And you know, it also puts them in maybe the same network of content that if your site gets a lot of hits or whatever, you kind of boost up.
But I don't doubt that you would get some work from it in the right circles or whatever. I mean, I don't know that I'd worry that much about the SEO of it. That seems weird. It's just a link, mm-hmm. dude. It's like, I don't know. I don't overthink things like that. Ethically, I don't know. Like, I wouldn't force it upon them or something. I'd be like, hey, do you mind if I involve, you know, put that in there? Or what would you do? Offer a discount? That feels weird too. I don't know. When I see it, it does look a little tiny bit unprofessional or amateurish to me.
Is gouch the right word? A little. yeah, it does. I think it's a little amateur, but if you're amateur, that's great. Like, get a link back. But yeah, I don't, you may be better off, like, you know, getting links on Twitter and links, you know, people talking about your work than you would, like, with the link back in the footer. That's maybe fair. More shares on Facebook and CSS galleries. I don't know that those are still a thing. I feel like Product Hunt is the new CSS gallery. So, you know, put it on Product Hunt or something. Yeah.
I just had to Google gouch and I don't think I spelled it right. It supports healthy kidney function. And then the Urban Dictionary one, you don't want to read at all.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Unsubscribe. Bleep it out, Chris.
Just kidding. No, it's just funny.
No, here, gouch, G-A-U-C-H-E. Gosh, I think. Okay, here. Having or showing a lack of awareness about the proper way to behave, a.k.a. socially awkward.
We should almost call this show Gouch Talk.
Gouch Talk. Gouch Talk. Hi, welcome to Gouch Talk. I will probably say something embarrassing.
Showing lack of awareness. This is an interesting one from Chris House, who's asking about pseudo elements. How do pseudo elements work? I mean, I know how to use them and I know what the end result, like the visual end result of is, but how do they actually work? If they're not part of the DOM, what are they? Ooh. So, you know, like after, like div colon colon after, right? Mm-hmm. And then you put stuff in there. So you might be able to like absolutely position it and apply a background image or, you know, make a triangle with it or do something. But you know, when you use a pseudo element like before or after, you have to use the content property too. Even if it's just content colon quote quote. So there's no content at all. You still need that for the pseudo element to show up at all. I still screw that one up sometimes. I'm like, why isn't this showing up? I'm like, oh yeah, you need content. So now let's say you've done it right. You've put the content in there. And the pseudo element now appears where you want it to. It's doing the thing it's going to do. Maybe there's some text there that you're adding. Maybe you're, you know, just adding a little visual flair that's just, it doesn't need to be part of the content, you know? Pseudo elements are great. I love it. I used to do a full 60-minute conference talk just on pseudo elements. Huge fan. Mm-hmm. But I take Chris's meaning. What are they? They're, you know, because, you know, they say they're not in the DOM, and he's kind of right about that in a sense that you can't really, for a long time, you couldn't even inspect them. I think modern versions of the Web Inspector now you can get to them, you know, if you open it up. And even then, it used to be an optional thing that you could turn on. You can't, for example, select them. If you add text, the browser just kind of ignores it. Actually, I saw a recent spec that may allow you to make them selectable, but they're not announced by screen readers, or they're not supposed to be, but they are in some screen readers. They're very confusing. What are they? How do you think about pseudo element?
It's weird. You like, because you can't get them with JavaScript.
I think you can though, but you're just not obviously. I think there's like a special DOM API just for getting them if you really have to.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, I mean, it's like generated content. That's how I think about it. And it has properties of a div or span. I guess it defaults to like a span. It's a generated span that appears in your markup. It's weird that it, I think they're weird that they exist, but they do, and they work pretty well. So, it's a phantom span. Can we call this, can somebody That's draw pretty good. A comic book cover called Phantom Span?
Yeah. It looks like the trick to getting it with JavaScript is you have to use window.getComputedStyle. In GetComputedStyle, you have to pass it a parameter, and you pass it a reference to a DOM element, right? So you pass it like a query selector result or something.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But it actually takes two parameters if you want, and you can go, you can pass GetComputedStyle the reference, comma, and then quotes colon before. So like there's a way, and then that's going to give you whatever GetComputedStyle returns, which is like an object of all the styles or whatever, or that returns like a reference too, and then that you have to do like get property value on. So like you can get data out of a pseudo element, like you can figure out through JavaScript like what is the content, what color is set, what's the background image, and you can set those properties, I think, too. But it's just tricky and weird. Like, it's like a second-class citizen in JavaScript almost. So, they are weird. But it is because you can do that, I think that technically means they are in the DOM. I mean, they're in there somewhere. They just don't have the same APIs that everything else does.
Yeah. That's wild. Because you can't be like, you know, element type of blah, 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 or, you know.
You can't get a direct reference to it. Like, you can't query selector for them. You have to query selector for the thing it's attached to, and then
parse that out or sniff it out. So
I think this will come up more and more with shadow DOM stuff, and because they're hidden in the same type of way that stuff inside a web component is hidden. I think so.
Oh yeah, is that? I guess would shadow DOM just be a like if I query selector my pizza, it. What does it return? Just a my pizza element, or does it return all the children?
Oh, I imagine there's fresh new APIs just for all that stuff.
Well, all right. Well, we'll have to.
What do we got next?
All right. Let's see here. We got a question from John McLaren. Writes in, I was wondering if you guys have been taking advantage of HTML imports. Well, speak of the devil.
Yeah, no kidding, right? Because we were just talking about web components, and HTML imports is part of that, like, land, isn't it?
Any pros and cons you've seen, and also if imports can be used within the body of a doc or only in the header. Ooh, this is a good question.
Oh, it really is, because it's the worst named thing ever. Like, I'm usually pretty open-minded. I would like to think about stuff like this. Like, I don't really care what the spec is, but you do an HTML import, and it literally can't import HTML. Like, it kind of can, but when you say HTML imports, what that means to me is like a PHP include or a Rails partial getting thing or every grunt has a thing for it. Like every single backend language in the world, Jekyll has some way to grab a little piece of HTML and stick it in this other piece of HTML. It's like we've needed this since the beginning of time on websites. We absolutely need this, and then HTML comes along and says, "Oh, we're gonna have imports now, but you can't do. We're gonna call it HTML imports, but you can't do the thing that you assume that it's gonna do, which is go get a piece of HTML and include it right here." It can't do that. It's only for like having one line be like, it's basically you can put a bunch of scripts and styles in a chunk of HTML, and an HTML import will be one line that goes and references that.
Yeah, it's like, it's basically you're importing a class like JavaScript or something and giving it a reference. So correct me if I'm wrong, Chris, didn't Firefox or Mozilla kind of put their foot down on imports specifically, saying like it's slow, like we're not doing it, it's slow?
Well, it's slow in that, you know how you like in regular CSS you never use @import because it's like it doesn't it's just slower than regular. It just it's just now you're requesting a file only to go to go get another file.
Yeah, like, so here it is on MDN. Firefox will not ship HTML imports. See this hacked blog post for more information. You can still use HTML imports by enabling the DOM.webcomponents.enabled flag. If you don't want the enabled flag, you can use a polyfill such as Google's web component JS. So they put their foot down. They just said straight up no.
Really? So.
So dead in the water.
Is it
Thanks,
though?
Mozilla.
I'm checking to see if this is real or not, because I have a perfect demo that I can put in the show notes. That because like I don't know, this is all. I have a pop. There's an article about web components on CSS tricks that I think Rob Dobson did for me, right? Yeah, Rob Dodson wrote it, and it's it doesn't work in Firefox. That's crazy. So he put a demo in, and he said, "This is how I'm going to explain web components to you. Let's say you want to build a slider, right? Well, the slider in HTML, it's going to have all this stuff, right? It's going to have a whole bunch of images." It's going to have, let's say we're going to use the cool CSS way to do it with sliders with a bunch of inputs and labels or whatever. Like, you're just going to need this big chunk of HTML that's just going to, like, be all the stuff that you need for a slider. That's fine or whatever, but, like, wouldn't it be a cool world if, like, to get a slider, all you needed to do in your web app was go, like, use the slider element and pass it a couple of images and, like, hide all the rest of that garbage from the rest of your document. It would be more semantic. It would just feel a little cleaner. It might be easier to develop. It would be less error prone. There's lots of reasons for this, right? So that's kind of what Web Components is. And Polymer was kind of a polyfill for it, but now is different. Now it's like more of like a set of helpers and stuff with it. But it was kind of like this HTML imports were kind of part of that world. Like Polymer had a polyfill for HTML imports that did it. Anyway, so there's a demo on this article called the Polymer Slider that he put together that uses, for all the dependencies of it, it uses an HTML import. So it's like link, you know, link rel style sheet is how you get a CSS file. This HTML include stuff that we're talking about is link rel import. And that's how we did all the components for it. And I opened it up in Firefox and it totally doesn't work. So you're right. They're not shipping it.
Yeah, it says, Mozilla will not ship an implementation of HTML imports. We expect that once JavaScript modules, a feature derived from JavaScript libraries written by the developer community, is shipped, the way we look at this problem will have changed. So they're kind of hedging bets. They're saying, like, when JavaScript modules, like, straight up, like, node-style modules hit, we might do things totally differently. It probably will be less HTML based and it'll be more reacty. Like
you could still polyfill this pretty easily. Like HTML.
Well, I mean, if you go to the Polymer site, that's all built on, you know, like Google's utilizing it heavily and it's really pretty good. It's really pretty fast. And, you know, I just don't think
HTML imports specifically are all that vital to this ecosystem. So if they're the one thing that isn't getting supported, it's like, oh, big deal. So I'm looking at the one that they use in this demo, and it's like, it's an include for a bunch of other stuff. And what's allowed in there is like, for example, other includes, but also like the definitions for web components, but in scripts and styles. So it's just like it becomes this one-liner that you drop into your app and it like has a bunch of dependencies inside of it. And it's like, that's easy. Just, you know, if you find to polyfill it, just look for any link element with rel import and just Ajax for this stuff instead.
Yeah. I think that's what it's going to end up being. But I don't know. I'm been thinking about maybe redoing my site with some of this because if you think about like what's been the biggest trend in like the last year or two, it's like all these pattern libraries and component libraries for your app. Like what if your Rails app just has to spit out components? It doesn't spit out pages at all. Like, or like you just stitch together these things. Like you do that in Rails already with like partials, but what if it was like just one big pot of partials, you know? Just React. Like HTML. Yeah, like React, basically. So, I don't know. It just seems like it could be really, really cool.
It is cool. I cannot get a industry-wide temperature on web components. It seemed like they were white hot and then dead and then lukewarm and then hot again. And then it's just like, I just don't get it. It's just.
Yeah, well, I think everyone's just kind of waiting for the dust to settle, and it seems like it didn't. I think Mozilla's kind of whatever hammer dropping here is bad news for it. But I don't know. I'd love to like build out a proof of concept like pattern lab or like style guide site using it and just see what I come up with. So, because like all your if you look at pattern library, it's atoms. Those are going to just be that's HTML. Like whatever's available in HTML, you know, atoms? Oh shoot, I messed it up. Molecules, which is going to just be like maybe tiny web components, and then organisms, which are kind of larger, more complex web components, like that import the imports. It seems like it fits very well into how people are developing websites at scale today. So
it kind of does, but it doesn't solve the single source of truth state. Like, it doesn't help you with state at all. You're still mm-hmm. on your own for that. So, like, that feels real world to me. Like, what if some data changes? How do I change it across a set of web components? Web components is like, shrug, I don't care. This isn't about that. Mm-hmm. Like, how can it not be?
Right. Like, how can we not care about, like, one-way or two-way data flow?
But maybe it shouldn't. Maybe that's like out of scope for this. And it's like there's no reason that you can't do smart data flow with web components. It's just it doesn't seem like anybody talks about that, at least in my world.
No, I think you're right. I think I don't know. But do you want like your HTML like do you? I don't know. I want my HTML like I want my TV, dumb as heck. You know.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. And that's probably smart and right. But like, where's the React for web components? Is it just not there? Does it exist and I just don't know about it? Or
is it some HTML import that you don't know about yet or something?
Right.
like maybe Rod Dodson's going to reply and be like, oh, we have like fake React here. I actually saw, sorry.
Or maybe.
saw some guy was telling a joke on Twitter and he was like, he rewrote like React app in web components.
Well, there you
go. And he was like, I don't hate this actually. So he just built out these web components and he's like, wait a minute, this is actually not too bad.
Well, they're both very well. There's Angular too, of course, and in web components is it's not a Google thing, but it is kind of like they work on it a ton, and obviously Angular's Google too. So there's an article right here from 2014 by Pascal Precht integrating web components with AngularJS. Maybe that's the Although there's not a lot of articles about this, so we'll see. Tell us what we don't know, Team Shop Talk. This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you in part by Braintree Payments. Why make payment integration more difficult than it has to be? Braintree's powerful full-stack payment platform allows you to accept nearly any type of payment from any device with just one integration. It's flexible to your system needs and supports most programming languages. So whether you're using Java, Ruby, Python, you'll always have a range of server-side and client-side SDKs available. Braintree makes payments and your job a whole lot easier. Learn more at braintreepayments.com/shoptalk. We got another one from Dom Johnson. What does he say?
Is that your real name, Dom? HTML pun?
We've had some nice segues with the names.
Okay, Dom Johnson, if that's your real name, I love it. I was wondering what your thoughts on content tombstones are. That's what Google calls them, and links to the Infinite Scroller article from last month about how you scroll a chat app and you have these little tombstones, these little like fake chat things, like a fake icon and some fake like.
Yeah, like when you look at Facebook and the little like fake boxes are there. Is that what we're calling them now? Tombstone?
I think they're being called tombstones.
I don't like it.
Probably not the best branding. Here we go. I've seen these around web apps, and I think they're an interesting way to act as placeholders for content that hasn't been rendered yet. Do you think all content-heavy sites should adopt practice like this, or with the advance of H2 coming along, would you foresee this becoming unnecessary?
I don't think those two things are necessarily related.
Like, yeah, I don't think eight networking is going to make it different. You know, it's more like you want to load a fake website first, and then and make the user feel like something has shown up, and then
You
load in the real stuff.
This thing is it's all a UX trick to make you feel good about the website having some latency and slowness and stuff, because they always will, you know. There'll always be some kind of, you know, data's got to travel into outer space and back or whatever it does under the ocean online.
So what do you think? I mean, do you think these are just like just how we'll do it?
No, I think it's a temporary trick that's working right now, and it'll be replaced by something else when it starts feeling like, ugh, everybody's doing it, because it's just a designery flair.
It is. Yeah. Like, so I'm thinking about it from like the user perspective. You're giving the user something they don't want that is useless, but you're just like trying to be like, see, look, something's there. The room isn't empty. There's something there. It's great. Right. And then something shows up. And the same with like those blurred photos. It's like, hey, look, it's a photo that you can't effing look
blurred
at.
Blurred photos is the same thing. Old school spinners. Remember when like
spinner,
when like the like loader.gif used to be like the way to do it. And no, you never do that anymore, because it just went out of phase. It went out of style a little bit.
So now tombstones are the new loader.
GIF. But they're kind of cool because they do a slightly better job of telling you what's about to show up, and they're approximately the same size as what's going to show up. So like they're a little better.
A little better. I guess, yeah, I'll give it a little better.
Just slightly
it's
better.
It's our official review.
Yeah. let's not call them tombstones. What's wrong with like placeholder content or placeholder box? I don't know. I guess it's not as catchy, but tombstone?
I got one. Ghost content.
Better.
Better, right?
Yeah.
See, tombstones is so negative. No one wants a tombstone.
Right. That's what you would do like when you're unloading the page. You know, like if you needed to. Yeah.
Here lied this page. here rendered this page. No. Yeah. I feel like my whatever, maybe it's a perspective of having made websites for a while, but I feel my like smeller's just going off. It's like you're just giving something the user can't use. So like, I don't know. I guess it's good. Like it does like trick them into thinking something has loaded, but like,
yeah.
Like again, like you tricked the user. Good job. High five.
Maybe
I don't
if
know.
We get what? Really, really, really good at shipping minimal interactive content would be cool. Like maybe that's some weird new future is that, and you see this occasionally, like, God, where I was on some page today, I think it was Western Union. I had to send somebody some money, and like I loaded the page and something was really slow. I was at a coffee shop and there's just a billion people in there and it loaded really slow. But I noticed that the very first thing to load was the form. It was the form that said, who do you need to send the money to and how much or whatever. That was the first thing that showed up on that page. And then as it chugged away, the frame for the rest of the site went in there. Well, like, that's kind of interesting. You know, like, that's a thing that I could actually probably start filling out. Like, I didn't, though, so I don't know how interactive it was. But, you know, if you were really careful, that seems kind of interesting to me. If you could start controlling, you know, having more control over what the browser renders first and what becomes interactive right away, and like as other things load, that it doesn't interfere with things that the user has done so far. I mean, that's obviously what we really want.
Yeah, like Google Chrome. I watched this weird like meeting online. It's on that standards of measurement post I did, but there's like a meeting video where all these, you know, Googlers are talking about like, how do we measure time to interactive? Cause that's kind of what matters more than first paint or DOM content loaded, or it's like, when is it active? When can you use it? So I think that's important. There's another thing, I guess, like, streams is maybe irrelevant, but like, HTTP2 is maybe irrelevant, but streams is a thing that Jake Archibald is really advocating. And this would be like, if your JSON comes back and the first packet has 10, you know, posts in it, it can render out those 10 posts. Like if you set up your JavaScript to like read streams, it'll render the first 10. And then like when the next 10 hit, it'll just render the next packet, then the next packet. So it'll render what it can, using streams. So I think that's kind of the next phase too. Like,
see, the thing about that, that's genius. And the stuff I was describing about how it loads and stuff, that the problem is those things are hard. Putting a box on it that has some little flash animation behind it is easy. And that's why it's popular, is because it's easy.
Mm-hmm. Yep. All right. Next question comes from Craig Jamieson. I have been trying to learn how to add animations and transitions to my site, but I'm struggling to find any useful tutorials on not only how to animate, but how to add these to my site. They not only play, but play only when visible. So like when you scroll or something, then they'll trigger. The right time. So I guess you need to make sure they're also loaded at the right time. I'm uncertain if this can be done with CSS or if I need to find a JavaScript library or something like that. Do you have any advice, references, courses, etc. I should look into?
It was exciting news in the last week or two. Val Head's new book is out, Designing Interface Animation, which we can put a link to in the show notes. I'm going to add it right here to our little Trello board. So that would be a good resource for learning, you know, how to animation, how to add it to sites, because she literally talks about interface animation, so you can't go wrong getting and reading that book. I wonder what your thinking is with animations that only play when they're visible. I mean, that's kind of clever, but I think you might be overthinking it a little bit. I think the browser does some optimizations there, so you don't have to worry about it too hard.
So you're going to have to if you want to like play when visible, you're going to have to kind of like do a trigger, right? You just sort of like a video game, when you step on a trigger, then something happens. So it's like usually when you on scroll and when you scroll and this like whatever section div shows up in the viewport, then you trigger the animation to start.
You're in JavaScript territory no matter what here.
Now you're in JavaScript territory. And on scroll is brutal for performance. So you got to be kind of like careful when you're doing it. You know, you can do it. Or you like hide the element and then you like on load, you trigger, like you add a class to your DOM, like everything loaded in, and then you start animating things in. The downside there is like, if your thing took 3 minutes to load on 3G, your users will just see a white screen. Nothing shows up until something shows up and then it comes in. So if you want one of those like really nice Apple-y style websites, you kind of have to put a lot of effort into it and a lot of device testing.
It doesn't sound like that's where you're at though, Craig, to me. It kind of just sounds like you're, you know, getting in just to learning about animations and stuff. And you might be overthinking the visibility part and load it at the right time part. Feel free to write back in, or if you end up going to forums and stuff, kind of explain what you want, explain what you're thinking, you know, like not only like I want to play an animation only when visible, but like what animation, why only visible, what are you trying to do exactly, you know, because the more information you have, the easier it is to like for us to figure out what the thinking behind it is.
If you need the JavaScript, there's like, you know, jQuery in viewport, or even there's an NPM like raw JavaScript in viewport plugin. So you can use that. I don't know. It's something to think about. So,
Is it performance is the concern, is performance the concern, or is timing the concern? It's one or the other.
Timing's a concern too, because you have like, you like get the HTML, and then the CSS blocks the HTML from rendering. That's just how HTML works. And then your script is going to go out later. Like or it should go out last unless you blocked everything. And you can block everything. HTML gives you that ability, like just put your script in the head. So you blocked everything from loading, but then like now you know, like when it loads, you can just detect the scroll. But you know, it's like if you're doing your JavaScript last, the chances of your user scrolling before the JavaScript loads and executes is pretty high. So they'll have to just wait until the JavaScript loads and executes before they can read your headline zip in. So
I wonder if that's or maybe that's literally what's being talked about here, is that, like, you know, as you scroll down, the boxes are sliding into view kind of thing. Maybe it's like mm-hmm. literally. In which case, there's plenty of tutorials on that. Slide in box. I just published one not so long ago on CSS tricks. So I'm going to put that.
I was shown a demo recently for this product called Webflow, not a sponsor of the show.
Webflow's we'll invoice awesome. You
later. Webflow's pretty cool, and it has these kind of, you know, like animations kind of pre-programmed. Like you can just say like on this, like animate the opacity and the everything in. And it kind of knows what to do with that. So that's something to think about too. If it's confusing to you, use a tool that does it, and then it gives you all the CSS and stuff, and just reverse engineer kind of what they did. So
indeed.
Like, or CodePen. Hey, welcome to CodePen.
Yeah.
you can like just build that one thing you're trying to animate and figure that out. So, but yeah, Val's book is going to tell you how to do it right too. So check out Val's book.
Melanie McLaughlin writes in, I'm the only front end dev at my job. The only one who consistently touches the CSS files, but occasionally CSS will be added at random by the other devs that work on projects and branches of those projects. Sometimes the added CSS is inline or embedded. Occasionally, it makes its way into the main CSS. So my question is more about, what is the best practice for keeping the CSS and less files manageable across teams? In the past month alone, I've cleaned up at least 5 cases that were created for the sole purpose of color red, when the class name red is color red. I've already existed. They wanted to make something red, so they made a new class called Red, and they put it in the style sheet that sets the color to red, and they did it 5 times. We have an outdated team style guide meant to clue the team in on what classes exist and could and should be used, but I think I'm the only person who looks at it. So this is a classic, like, we have a style guide, but it's not working because it's not the people who need it aren't using it.
Mm-hmm.
That's classic. I've heard more of this historically than I have heard about the success of style guides. You know, the old refrain on style guides was, yeah, sure, sounds good in theory.
When I listened to this, I think my immediate response, my gut, my visceral response was, you have an education problem. Right. Like if somebody's writing color style equals color red instead of using the class red, you have an education problem. You may have a code problem where like maybe red is just a bad class name, you know, like error would probably be better, right, or something like that. But you have an education problem, and that goes two ways. Like the more robust your style guide gets, the more things that go in it, and the greater chance that no one's going to read it. We're working with a company right now. They have a style guide, but like they kind of, it grew, and now they have like the styles, and they have components, and they have modules. And you're just like, well, what's components and what's a module? Like, literally don't know. Okay, let me go through this. Let me figure it out. I think, you know, Pattern Lab deals with the same thing. You know, what's an organism? What's a molecule thing? Oh gosh, I don't remember. So now, like, you have an education problem. My suggestion, I don't know, I'm just riffing here, but like, do brown bags, like lunches things where you like just explain what code you have and what CSS you already wrote. And maybe that'll help people kind of understand, like, whatever, be less creative. You want people to be a little less creative. in what they're doing. But
remember, last week we talked about junk CSS. This is another great use case for it. If you're like having trouble communicating, like, oh, here, these are the, you know, visit this style guide whenever you need anything, and like maybe that's like too hard of a order. Maybe the style guide is failing you. Like, it would be awesome if it wasn't failing you, but it is. So maybe a baby step is to use the junk CSS thing and be like, hey, everybody, if you need to write some CSS, go for it. I know that sometimes you need CSS. I don't want to prevent you from doing that, but could you please put it into don't call it junk because that feels rude at this point. Call it like extras.css or something. And then you make it your job to occasionally go through extras, see who committed what, and be like, oh, hey, Tom, I see you put a class red in extras. Did you know that we already have class error? I'm going to go ahead and, you know, make your HTML use class error and remove that from extras.css. Then it becomes like this place that starts the communication. That seems kind of cool to me. You know, that junk CSS idea is clever.
Still working all these years. I think that would be a good place to start, because you have an education problem, and then you just have a people just getting their job done problem, that, you know, they're not taking the time.
Never prevent that, you know.
Right, and I think it's just kind of like people just, they're choosing to inline styles rather than talk to other people about it. I think that's kind of a workplace problem too. I think you could probably put your foot down, like, and just be like, no, inline styles or whatever, like, don't do any of that. Don't figure out. I think you're gonna have to communicate. If five people are writing the same class to change the color, then that's a problem. So all right, well, Chris, guess what? That's all the questions we have for today. Yeah. Thank you.
Please send more in. We've gotten some good ones lately, but we definitely need more. So I think on average, we get less than we need to fill up an episode a week. Only lately. So we still have plenty of archives to work our way through, but the best questions are more timely, you know? So, you know. If you want us to talk about modern stuff, send in modern questions and we'll discuss them.
Otherwise, it's SAS versus less. should I be using SAS? Because we got about 50 of those. Are you ready for those? We'll do a whole show dedicated to using SAS. Yeah. All right. Well, hey, thanks everybody for listening to this in your podcatcher of choice. Please star heart favorite this up and tweet about the show. That's how people find out, and we really appreciate that. Follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show for tens of tweets a month. And if you hate your job, head over to shoptalkshow.com/jobs. Get a brand new one. Companies want to hire you. And Chris, do you have anything else?
Just one tiny little one. I'll probably mention it a number of times here on Chop Talk Show, but just right now, or in the last few days, my new book, Practical SVG, has dropped literally on a book apart. And I know that sounds like a joke here on Chop Talk Show, but this is an actual a book apart book that was actually published. It's called Practical SVG, and you can buy it with the link in the show notes, or just Google Practical SVG, or follow me on Twitter, where I'll be annoying out about it probably for the next month or so. So,
congrats on the book, by the way. I'm jealous, and, you know, we're gonna figure it out. It's a great book, though. Really good job, Chris. What the heck is up? Anyway,
we'll do some more hopefully some shows kind of about it, talking about SVG and what's inside it, maybe some guests. I don't know, but I'd like to talk about it because it's on my mind, because I published the book, obviously, and very obviously and unabashedly I'd like to sell some copies of it, please.
And SVG is so hot, is a different world, and if you're struggling to understand it, check it out. It
truly is, and it's underused. That's one of the reasons. That down. I'm telling people reasons why I should buy the book, and underused is a big, it's literally underused on the web.
Can I say another one?
Yeah.
Can I just riff on reasons? If you're bored, just making boring old websites, mix in some SVG there, make things spin around, do something fun.
Mix it up. That's a great way to mix it up.
It's good. It's good. Go to all right. That's all I got. Congrats on the book. I'm totally not jealous.
Oh, I'm jealous of you in more ways than you know, Dave. All right, ChopDocShow.com.